Alrighty, everyone. So thank you all for coming. thank you all for coming to the Spiritual Brain. I'm super excited to have Michael Adam Ferguson present for us. And I just learned that he had a pet rat. And so, two. So yeah, he's my new favorite. All right, so brain science has matured to the point where it is beginning to subsume the philosophical discipline of religious phenomenology. In this session, Dr. Michael Ferguson will lead attendees through an exciting spiral of divine ascent, complete with detailed mechanisms for cognitive and neural dynamics of theosis, also known as divine imitation. The best of contemporary science and the highest expression of Christian theology are fused in the extraordinary presentation that he will present for us today. So Michael is a Harvard and Cornell trained neuroscientist publishing groundbreaking empirical and theoretical research on spirituality across peer-reviewed disciplines. He is the host of The Spiritual Brain, which is coming out in November, and lives in Boston with his husband, Seth. He also prefers his caffeine cold. He likes iced tea.
Thank you guys so much for being here. This is really, really exciting to see so many loving, wonderful, beautiful, fresh, happy, familiar faces. We're going to start this off like any good restoration movement event and have a group hymn sing. Come, come, ye scientific saints. Can y'all see the lyrics here? We're going to do this not just a cappella, but rockapella, guys. Okay? How is this pitch? If we need to, like, do a different pitch, we can. But if we do, come, come, ye saints, no facts nor data fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this science may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive, our childish notions from us to drive. Do this and light, your minds will swell. All is well, all is well. Verse 2. Why should we mourn, or think the truth is hard? 'Tis not so, all is right. Why should we think to earn a great reward, if we shun greater light? We'll make the air with reason ring, find logos of our God and King. Do this and light, your minds will swell. All is well. All is
five
well.
More verses. Just one of those.
And should we die before our funding's through, happy day, all is right. We then are free from cold reviewer too, and shall dwell with the bright. But if our lives are spared again to see our grant money all get spent, oh, how we'll make this chorus swell.
Yes. Now you gotta just hold it, hold it. Yes, Jesus. And that's the Spiritual Brain. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to materialize the conversation here using, and I'm going to be really upfront, this is complex stuff. We're using a four-level model here that crosses disciplines of theology, philosophy, cognitive science, and neuroscience. And we're going to try to wrap these up in one beautiful, juicy vision of the spiritual brain in 50 minutes or less. Okay, so there's going to be a lot of jargon. And I apologize in advance. I want to try to break that down, digest it, make it accessible, but jot down notes because I don't want anybody feeling like, I don't know what that word is. I must not be that smart about this. No, this is jargony stuff. Ask a question. If there's a word that you need clarification for, please let me know. I'll take more substantive questions and comments at the interim summary point and at the end. But if there is a term that is just throwing you off, please let me know. When I talk about dualism, so this is in metaphysics, you have this idea that we could have one unified reality where the material nature is the totality of the human experience and of the cosmos and everything. Dualism is the idea that there is a separate world, a separate reality that's more sacred, that's set apart from this reality. And dualistic thinking is that, oh, if we want to get in touch with the divine or with holiness, then we need to appeal to something outside of this reality. Okay, there's some problems with this. One of them is this idea of infinite regress, that if you're constantly deferring what constitutes divinity and sacredness to another realm, then well, what makes that realm sacred and divine? Maybe the realm before that. And then, well, what makes that realm sacred and divine? Well, maybe the realm before that. And so we just have this ongoing runaway train where we never really embrace, connect, and find presence with divinity and sacredness. And that's one of the possible pitfalls of a dualistic point of view. With the philosophy of divinity, this goes at least as far back to the classic Greek thinkers of philosophy. And so Plato has a thought experiment that's called the Euthyphro Dilemma. And the gist of it is that he wants people to ponder whether gods make good or whether good makes gods. And in the Josephine expression of Christianity, or in other words, the Christian tradition that was filtered through the mind and life of Joseph Smith, it is very clear what the answer to the Euthyphro Dilemma is. The Mormon theological proposition is that it is good that makes gods. So queer theology is kind of the new darling of academia, or queer theory, excuse me. Queer theory is one of the darlings of academia right now. And so two of the central principles of queer theory are, one, to centralize the marginal. So things that have been relegated to the outskirts, queer theory says, let's actually bring that in and look at it more closely and make that our central focal point. There's also a core principle in queer theory, which is that of rupturing binaries. So, you know, very typically this is thought of in terms of the gender binary of, you know, the simplistic male-female model of gender, but this really could be applied to a range of different topics. This idea of taking a conceptual binary and then saying, you know what, I'm just going to be suspicious of anything that says it's this or this and paints reality as something that has this divide intrinsic to it. And so I'm going to talk about this when we talk about the material and the spiritual. I really want to push and challenge this idea that the material and the spiritual are binary realms that are separate from one another. I would actually say that the quintessential queer theologian was Jesus of Nazareth. His ministry and calling succinctly were to rupture all the binaries. The binaries between humanity and divinity through the mystery of incarnation. The binary between life and death through the mystery of resurrection. The binary of profane elements and sacred elements through the mystery of Eucharist or the Last Supper, the mystical supper, depending on your traditional expression. So one of the things that Jesus said to those who were listening to his preaching was that if I can't even tell you about earthly things and have you grasp them, how can I tell you about heavenly things and hope for you to grasp them? And I think of this in terms of materialism and the beautiful revelations that we've had of the past century and a half of organic evolution, of the way that life evolved on this planet. And I think about how there is such an unsettled tension, that is such an unnecessary tension in my mind between the evolutionary paradigm and the theological paradigm, where I say, okay, if I can't even talk about the evolution of animals, how can I talk about the evolution of gods? But that's where we're going to be going here. So the goals are to enrich the cognitive science discourse about human spirituality, and then to map
the neurophysiological dynamics. Highfalutin word just means brain activity patterns and how spirituality emerges from those. What is spirituality? And this is a free response. There's no right or wrong answer. I'm not going to berate or embarrass anybody, but I'm curious how you would define spirituality. Okay, so three keywords that I pull from what you're saying here are there's something about having an open disposition that seems related to spirituality. There's something about having access to some realm of gnosis or knowledge or wisdom that's not our typical default waking reality. And then what was the third thing that you said? You said openness, access. What's that?
The infinite.
That, there you go. The sense that we're somehow continuous with the totality of what exists. Yeah?
And I would just, for me, it's also that it's those things and it's that access to another dimension. Like it's something outside our more material or cognitive, hopefully, space.
Very cool. Yeah, Mike.
This doesn't exclusively define spirituality. Spirituality
emphasizes You always are going to throw something in that makes me want to respond with more time than I have. So Mike said that spirituality emphasizes the emotion over the intellect. We'll talk more about that. Yes. That there's something eternal that's signified when we talk about spirituality. Let's do like two more here, but these are so good. I love that you're talking. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, especially if your paradigm of spirituality is that it's, by definition, the ineffable. Then how can you F the ineffable? Yeah. Cool. Yes. There was a large response of affirmation to that. Very cool. So something about the profound interconnectivity that's just the nature of reality. And then Melly, go ahead. Very good stuff. Okay, one more, just because you guys are so full of wisdom here. You guys are so good. This is by no means the authoritative definition, unless you like call me the authority, then it could be the authoritative definition. But my working definition here for spirituality is the integrative cognitive, so what you think, affective, what you feel, and neuroscience, what your brain is physically doing, processes for wisdom discovery and meaning production. So lots of resonance here. There's certainly elements that I fully agree with, interconnectivity, ineffability, almost unknowability. Unknowability and science don't necessarily work well together, so this is the definition that I'm going with to pursue a scientific model. It does. Very true. If you can do, I'm going to go to your spiritual math presentation next. That would be wonderful. So what are spiritual experiences? Without using the term spirit or experience to define spiritual experiences, here's one candidate definition. But spiritual experiences are peculiar states of consciousness in which the individual discovers his, her, or their self to be one continuous process with God, with the universe, with the ground of being, or whatever name they may use by cultural conditioning or personal preference for the ultimate and eternal reality. So why should we care about spirituality? And particularly, as scientists, why should we care about spirituality? Well, again, this is one answer that I offer for your consideration. And I'll defer to Emile Durkheim, who is the father of modern sociology. And he talked about how sociocultural attachments, so in other words, the non-rational, emotional, heart-based connection that we have to people, to ideas, to institutions, that those arise secondary to a shared group consensus about what constitutes the sacred. And so it's an important note that Durkheim is not referring to the sacred as a metaphysical proposition. He's not saying, oh, I'm talking about an alternate dimension of angels and gods. He's saying that the sacred is what individuals join together and collaboratively define. And so he's talking about the sacred as a psychological category. All right, now, when we talk about the spiritual mind from a supernaturalistic point of view, the center point, one of the center points that a person could define is God. There are actually non-theistic spiritualities that we could consider supernatural. For the intents and purposes of this presentation, I'm starting from a theistic spiritual supernaturalism. So God bestows personal revelation, which gives rise to personal wisdom, which then translates into gnosis, into a profound mystical knowledge about the ultimate nature of God. And then that feeds back into additional personal revelation. And so you can think about this as cycles of divine atonement, where we're progressively and iteratively learning more about the nature of divinity, embodying more of the attributes of divine presence, and then bringing that here into our physical realm. Supernaturalistic models don't really go well in scientific conferences. And so the challenge, or one of the challenges, is to translate without losing some of the substance, to translate these concepts into a naturalistic point of view. I start by putting native intelligence at the centerpiece of my model for the spiritual mind from a naturalistic point of view. And admittedly, this is a maneuver that is motivated by Josephine Christian theology, where you have in the Doctrine and Covenants the proposition that the glory of God is intelligence, or in other words, light and truth. And so if we're trying to translate theology into philosophy and cognitive science, hey, native intelligence is a really great place to start, where philosophy, cognition, and neuroscience all have a claim. This is some of the work that I've done that's been published in MIT Press and the journal Network Neuroscience that looks at one of the attributes of brains that are more intelligent is that they have heightened synchrony in networks at rest. So this right here is what's called the basis set of networks that are active during a neutral, wakeful, resting state. And it turns out that of the most 10 dominant networks in your resting state, that 8 of them are predictive for intelligence based on the internal synchrony of those networks. So in other words, if your ventral attention network has a greater degree of synchrony between the components of that network, that's conducive to greater intelligence emerging from that brain. The human brain, quick anatomy lesson here, has several levels to it that represent different epochs of evolutionary development. The most recent real estate in the brain is called the cerebral cortex. And it's the one that does all of the fun things like abstract thought and critical reasoning and thinking of poetry. The cortex then is a shell over the subcortex.
And within the subcortex, you have these really ancient and powerful nuclei in the brain that can change the setting of what the cortex is doing. In some of the research that I'm putting through publication right now, I'm demonstrating that this, let's see, can I do it with the mouse? No. Do we have a, we don't happen to have a laser pointer, do we? That's that one. Perhaps. Thanks. I'm not sure if that is, actually. But this, so I'll just talk loud. So this region of the subcortex is called the hippocampus. So lock that in mind, hippocampus. And in a more intelligent brain, it turns out that in the absence of a specific task constraint, so when your brain is just spontaneously wandering, that more intelligent brains are accessing the left hippocampus with greater regularity. And so we're going to get into more detail about what the hippocampus is and what it does. But the thing to hang on to here is that intelligence is partially a product of the hippocampus and the cortex communicating with one another during spontaneous thought. So then you have an inverse relationship between another subcortical region called the nucleus accumbens and the most anterior portion of your cortex, which is the real estate in your brain that's involved in very highly abstract processes. Your brain has a gradient that as you move forward toward your face in your brain, that the representations that are being operated on are more and more abstract. So when you see a hot spot at the very, very tip of the brain, that indicates that this is likely related to cognition that is extraordinarily abstract in its nature. So more intelligent brains during rest have less spontaneous triggering of the reward system by abstract thought. Whereas brains that are less intelligent tend to have a greater spontaneous firing of the reward system in response to highly abstract thought. So the two things to kind of hang on to in your working memory for now are hippocampus, nucleus accumbens, that those are part of the story. All right, so moving up in this model here, we start with native intelligence. Native intelligence expresses agency by choosing the setting and the state in which an individual will have a conscious experience. So what do we mean by that? You all chose, on some level, to put yourself in this setting, in this space. You chose, on some level, to follow the group into a state of mind that is more attuned to these subtle, difficult considerations. And by the selection of your setting and the selection of your state of mind, your conscious experience is going to be fundamentally defined. Two general flavors of altered conscious states are in the directions of hyper-aroused consciousness and hypo-aroused consciousness. There is a really fantastic 1971 science article called A Cartography of Understanding Mysticism that maps out the way that the brain is physically operating differently depending on whether the mind is in a hyper-aroused conscious state, a default neutral waking state, or a hypo-aroused state of conscious experience. And so we'll cartoonize this a little bit to try and make the concepts more attainable. In a hyper-aroused state, think of ecstatic spiritual experiences. So speaking in tongues or something where you're feeling a lot of joy and animation and motivation. Then on the other side of that spectrum, hypo-aroused states of consciousness. And in philosophy of mind that focuses on mystical experience, there is a technical differentiation between mystical states that reflect sensory deprivation, that they reflect the quieting of the mind, versus ecstatic states that represent greater mental excitation. So then flowing out of conscious experience, we can have these settings of being hyper-aroused, default arousal, or hypo-arousal. And depending on your state of consciousness, you will fundamentally experience reality differently, both your external and your internal realities. Again, the hyper-aroused states are sensory-rich There's heightened awareness, ecstatic feelings of joy, rapture, visions, and high mental energy, but not necessarily effortful mental energy. And then the cognitive elements are quasi-perceptual processes. So in other words, experiencing some kind of visual or some kind of auditory event that's not being created by your physical sensory environment. We did a study when I was a graduate student here at the University of Utah where we took Latter-day Saint Return missionaries, put them in an fMRI brain scanner, and then had them participate in spiritual practices like prayer, reading the Book of Mormon, watching General Conference videos. And while they were inside of the scanner, they had a button box on their chest so that they could tap a button and indicate to us when they were feeling the spirit. So what we were able to do then is to go through and say, okay, at each of those moments in time when our participants pressed the button, what was happening in the brain above and beyond what was happening during non-spiritual events? And three of the core regions include the frontal attention regions. So think again, we were talking about hyperarousal, that you have greater attentive awareness. The medial prefrontal cortex, which is involved in valuative processes, looking at the meaning and commitment that you have to different abstract notions. And then, perhaps most provocatively and interestingly, the nucleus accumbens, which again, that's one of those subcortical regions that we were talking about. And the nucleus accumbens, to take this now into molecular space above and beyond neuroanatomical space, the nucleus accumbens is loaded with the molecule dopamine. Hang on to that. Dopamine is going to come up a couple of other times here in our journey. If you're interested in hearing more about my study in the LDS population, feel free to YouTube my talk. It was a TEDx talk I gave here at the University of Utah called This Is Your Brain on God. And it goes into a lot more of the data as well as some of the interpretations for that particular study on LDS return missionaries. Okay, so let's go to the other side of the spectrum, into the hypo-aroused conscious states. So phenomenally, these include low sensory input, trance-like states of minimal awareness, in contrast to where we saw when people are feeling the spirit in the Mormon, you know, vernacular, that they have heightened attentional awareness. So basic hypnosis. I'm just curious, who, if anybody here, has been hypnotized before? Okay, so we've got some hypnotizable folks here. So you have some experiential connection with these states of hypo-aroused awareness. Also basic meditation, breath meditation, transcendental meditation, draw on these hypo-aroused conscious states. And they're typified by low mental energy. The cognitive aspects are what are referred to as perceptual decoupling. So perception is the way that you're becoming aware of your physical environments. Decoupling meaning that that awareness with your physical environment is not as tightly bound. And there's really compelling work to indicate that an individual deliberately going into a hypo-aroused conscious state generates insightful awareness. So this is a basis of like a lot of insight meditation, or again, like TM, transcendental meditation, if folks have had experience with that. Yeah. That would be a hypo-aroused state, where it's just, it feels like your mind, in Buddhism, the analogy that they use is that your mind is just a glassy lake. And when your mind is that glassy lake, your mental gaze can penetrate more deeply into what's happening. Hypnosis is the oldest Western conception of psychotherapy, and it's a top-down resetting of your perceptual responses. It's your mind altering the way that your brain is experiencing reality. It turns out that there are individual differences in the hypnotizability of people. And specifically, we can predict how hypnotizable a person is by looking at how strong the connection is between their left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and between what's called the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex. And I know those are just jargony terms right now, but the point that I want you to derive from that is that
we are at a state in our neuroscience right now where we can predict individual differences for these very subtle things like how hypnotizable an individual is. It turns out that those two regions, the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, as well as the lateral prefrontal cortex, are targets from the dopamine system. Dun, dun, dun.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah, so these two regions in the brain whose communication predicts how much an individual is susceptible to hypnotism, those two regions in the cortex have targets from the subcortex that are dopamine rich that are projecting to them. So dopamine, again, is showing up here in the hypo-aroused conscious experience. And we also saw in the LDS study that dopamine is showing up to participate in hyper-aroused experiences. So it starts to paint a picture where, okay, we've now got a specific biomolecular system that we can start to bring into our investigation about spirituality. Hypnotizability, so again, how susceptible an individual is to a hypnotic induction, has also been correlated with levels of dopamine metabolites in the cerebrospinal fluid. So dopamine metabolites are when dopamine has been circulating and it starts to break down, that you can see those trace remnants of dopamine as it's breaking down in cerebral spinal fluid, which is the liquid that bathes your brain and buoys it up. Your brain is an organ in a vat. Like, the Matrix is real and it's inside your skull. You also have what are complex conscious phenomena, where the individual's mental state can, I use scare quotes here, can travel across hyper-aroused or hypo-aroused conscious conditions. And so an example of a complex conscious phenomena that probably most people have experience with is dreaming. This is a complex event wherein you first go into a hypo-aroused state. Your brain stops receiving bottom-up input from your body. It starts back-propagating the information that's already contained in your brain. Then, when that information reaches a certain threshold, it takes over your sensory cortex and flips you into this hyper-aroused state of consciousness where you start having quasi-perceptual experience. You start having visuals. If you're a very vivid dreamer, you can start having auditory components to your dreams. And of course, we know that dreams are not our direct interaction with the physical environment the same way that our typical vision or our typical auditory experience would be. And yet these are very powerful experiences that people derive a lot of meaning from. How many of you ever had experience with, did you have a question? Or? Yes. Well, okay. Yes, possibly. So it depends on the type of spiritual experience. Because if the spiritual experience is that you just have this sense that the boundary of your ego has dissolved and you have melted into oneness with the totality of the universe, that's probably more of like a hypo-aroused state. But if by spiritual experience you mean that like you quiet your mind and then you almost have this bursting forward of images or ideas, that would be more of this complex conscious phenomena where you have a quieting and then a bursting into a hyper-aroused state. So I'm curious, has anybody had experience with sensory deprivation chambers before? Yeah, okay. And did you have visuals? Anybody have like a dramatic sensory deprivation experience they want to share? It's fine if you don't feel comfortable with it. No, okay. So in a sensory deprivation tank, you've got, you know, saline, so you're buoyant. It's dark, so you don't have light that's hitting your retina and making images. It's very quiet. And the idea is to have your brain basically forced into the types of conditions that trigger dream states, but to do it while you're awake. That actually would draw on very similar types of systems to have
to facilitate those experiences. Okay. Was there another comment? Oh, you're just, okay. Cool, okay, so I want to accelerate just a little bit, so no offense if I don't take as many comments and questions, because I just want to get through some of this material. So, like we were talking about, the way that you experience reality is contingent on your conscious state. Also, the way that you encode your experience into your memory, into your autobiographical memory, is contingent on your conscious state. We don't encode and retain in our memory every single detail about episodic experiences. We encode and retain the salient features of those experiences. And again, what is salient about an experience is going to depend on your conscious state. The work that I'm doing right now at Harvard Medical School is related to amnesia lesions. So looking at 54 case studies where patients have come in, they've had a stroke. This is a map of all 54 lesion sites laid on top of each other. And so you can see they're kind of all over the brain. Even though these are patients who present to their neurologist with severe amnesia, it's not just a single insult site in the brain that produces this common symptomology. There are lesions all over the brain that can produce this common symptomology. So one of the things that we're looking at, though, is, okay, can we at least look at what each of those lesions is connected to and find some overlap in what those regions are connecting with? And it turns out that, yes, we can. So we're working on defining an autobiographical memory circuit in the brain that largely draws on the hippocampus. And so remember we were talking before about the hippocampus and about how during wakeful, neutral states that more intelligent brains will spontaneously transfer information back and forth between the hippocampus and between the cortex. So with those autobiographical memories then, each of us go through these reconsiderations of our autobiographical experience. Why did this happen? What did this really mean? How can I understand this differently? There's this epicycle, this back and forth exchange between our hippocampus, between our memory, and between our cortex, between our intelligence, that I assert and argue is foundational for the emergence of wisdom from our cognitive processes. Since you're here, you probably heard the scripture before, James 1:5. It kind of kicked off this whole fiasco. But it says, oops. There we go. That if any of you lack wisdom, let them ask of God, who gives to all people liberally and will not upbraid you. And then I would say relatedly is scripture from the New Testament as well that talks about memory and says, but the Comforter, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, he will teach you all things and bring to your remembrance all that I have said to you. In spiritual worldviews, wisdom is almost universally centralized as one of the highest human virtues. And wisdom, it's sort of like porn, where it's difficult to define, but you know it when you see it. Wisdom, though, if we're trying to define it, it derives from high-level pattern abstractions of our remembered experiences. And philosophical and cognitive definitions converge on intellectual humility as necessary for the emergence of wisdom. So intellectual humility, again, think of these cycles of going back and forth between autobiographical memory and native intelligence to say, you know what, maybe I didn't understand that situation correctly the first time around. That humility to reappraise is, from cognitive science literature, identified as being crucial for the development of wisdom. It's also really promising and hopeful as well that as cognitive science is starting to look at wisdom, and you can, I mean, maybe you can't see at the very bottom here, these are citations from 2017, from this year. So like, I'm really, really excited that the fields of cognitive and neurosciences are starting to come around to these topics. I think that's really cool. It's hopeful that we're seeing that experiential, situational, and cultural factors are even more powerful in shaping wise thinking than we had previously imagined. That in other words, it's not like you're born with genes for wisdom or genes to not be wise. That there's a lot that your life experience can contribute to the wisdom of your being. Okay, moving on then, we take those autobiographical memories
And each of us creates some type of narrative to weave our autobiographical experiences into one circumscribed whole. So these are highly determined by our cultural factors, that if you have an individual who has a particular spiritual experience during a state of profound prayer or meditation, and they grew up in a Muslim country or a Muslim household, they're going to have a different attribution than someone who grew up in a Wiccan household. It can, you know, you could have the same neural process that's driving an experience, but depending on your cultural framing, the interpretation and understanding that's constructed from those experiences could be very, very different from one another. Ultimately, these go into the service of building an individual sense of life meaning. Meaning answers the question, what makes life worth living? And one of the cognitive paradigms right now about the emergence of meaning from cognition is that it is secondary to successfully integrating episodes of your autobiographical experience into one continuous narrative. Yeah.
So what you just said about different cultural backgrounds taking that experience, that's connected into behavior.
Absolutely. So the question is, are those differences in the attribution of meaning related to differences in behavioral outcomes? Very insightful. The answer is yes. And we're going to get to that in actually the next step of the model. Yeah. So that's a really great question. So the question is the degree to which there is an overlap of networks in the brain that respond subsequent to the generation of meaning. And that's actually research that I'm chasing down right now. Like I said, I've done some work in a Mormon population. I've done some work in a Buddhist population. And I really want to do ongoing work in Catholics and Muslims and Orthodox and Wiccans to get to those exact questions of, okay, do we see this universal spiritual system in humanity? Or is it many roads when you get to the neural networks that are involved in spiritual systems? And that's an empirical question. I just don't have the answer right now to give to you. Come to my talk in 5 years, and I hope I can give you something more concrete. So as far as this cognitive theory of the emergence of meaning from the successful interweaving of autobiographical episodes from one's memory, these, once again, are articles that are coming out this year. This is a 2017 Science article, How You Makes Meaning. In other words, how your construction of selfhood gives rise to the sense that there is something meaningful in life. And then from Current Directions in Psychological Science, this one's from 2013, talking about narrative identity. And I'm not going to go into too much detail about these, but I put these references up here in case you're interested in looking into this in more detail for yourself. Okay, so then the next step here is the emergence of purposeful questing. And this gets into this question about behavioral responses secondary to spiritual experience and the generation of a personal meaningful narrative. You have persistent behavior that we think of as traits. So if someone has life meaning, where they say that, you know, the meaning of life is that this is a world that's out to kill you, that doesn't have your interests in mind, that you have to fend for yourself, that type of life meaning that has been generated is going to have very different purposeful questing behavior that comes out of it, as opposed to someone who's created this life meaning where they say, I'm here to build utopia. I'm here to serve God. That's going to have a different organic response depending, again, on the way that that personal narrative has been crafted. And then that purposeful questing behavior loops back around and informs the types of settings and states that we continue to pursue in our conscious experience, and then we enter into another round of this cycle. So think of going through these spiritual cycles and accumulating a robust sense of life meaning. In data that's collected by the National Institutes of Health Human Connectome Project that I've been analyzing, there is a very strong positive relationship between an individual having a robust sense of life meaning and the individual having
positive affect, or in other words, that they're a typically happy individual. This is one of the connecting points where I actually see a lot of hope and promise for new ways of addressing depression. If we can start to integrate spiritual models and spiritual cognition into the way that we're talking about depression symptoms, I think that there's a huge complementary angle that we can pursue in order to really address some of the root symptoms from a cognitive, behavioral, spiritual perspective. The opposite way that if a person has experiences in which their narrative of life meaning is challenged or derailed, this is related to negative affect. This is related, again, to feelings of hopelessness, to feelings of high anxiety and neuroticism. And this depletion leads to clinical problems. That this is a space in which we're not just talking about esoteric abstract theology. We're talking about the number one disease burden in the industrialized world outside of heart disease, depression. We don't have a good handle on that right now. Okay, so the interim summary is that we have this spiritual model where the core is our native intelligence. That's related to the synchrony within brain networks. It's related to your hippocampus and your cortex having a spontaneous transmission of information back and forth during neutral resting states. The nucleus accumbens and that very front tip part of your brain that does highly abstract thought, that the less spontaneous reward that you have to abstract thought, that the more intelligent that you're likely to be. That we talked then about conscious experiences, the way that we can choose our setting and our state to have either a hyper-aroused or a hypo-aroused state of consciousness, which in turn affect the type of spiritual experiences that an individual has. We talked about hypnotizability as an example of that hypo-aroused conscious condition. Autobiographical memory, which we're illuminating, is very tethered to the hippocampus as a central component of this memory circuit. And then those moving forward into the way that individuals narrate their selfhood, their identity, and generate a sense of life meaning and purpose. I'm actually going to... Oh, okay, it's Mike, so I have to take Mike's question. Go ahead. Okay. I'm just going to skip this because I want to get through some of the stuff that might rile you up a little bit here. So my question is, can we take the understanding of mind and brain and help illuminate spiritual and religious histories in new, useful ways? So if we think, once again, of these complex conscious phenomena as neural movement across conscious states, wait for it, how might these relationships between neural and cognitive processes help us think about Book of Mormon production? That was an audible. Well, there we go. If you don't have access to a saline temperature regulated sensory deprivation chamber, maybe a top hat will help. If you think about the conditions that Joseph Smith reports were necessary to produce text, he talks about the sensory deprivation, and not just from face and top hat, curtain, but, so Seth and I, we lived in Ithaca while I was going to Cornell in upstate New York. It's 90 minutes from Palmyra, it's 40 minutes from the Whitmer farm where a lot of the Book of Mormon was produced. Girl, there ain't nothing there. So you want to talk about sensory deprivation? Like, upstate New York is like a great place to be sensory deprived. So Joseph also talked about that there had to be neutral affect, there had to be neutral emotion. He said that if him and Emma had a disagreement or a dispute, he had to go and resolve it before he could get back into that spiritual state of producing text. So, yes, I am being speculative here, but when you look at the ways in which the conditions necessary for Book of Mormon production align with conditions necessary for some of these complex conscious phenomena, it's a very nice overlay.
Dan Vogel, in his book, The Joseph Smith, The Making of a Prophet, he argues for an autobiographical understanding of Book of Mormon production, that in essence, Joseph Smith viewed himself as being divinely called. Joseph Smith was sincere in his belief about his spiritual giftedness. And Vogel argues that the Book of Mormon largely reflects Joseph Smith's own life situations and dilemmas that he was processing and reconciling. So when we're talking about the spiritual brain of Joseph Smith, it is scientifically impossible to make definitive statements about the brain states of Joseph Smith during his spiritual experiences. Given the proliferating details about relationships between brain activity and mental activity, I argue that we can make informed speculations. Joseph Smith has a constellation of salient traits, including hypergraphia, so this is a tendency for extensive and compulsive writing, hyperreligiosity, intense, persistent religious feelings and interests, and atypical sexuality, patterns of sexual behavior that are not socially normative, including hypersexuality. And it turns out that these are the three traits that define a condition called Gershwin syndrome. Yeah, and this is just a very nice life coincidence that I find very rewarding and satisfying, that Norman Gershwin actually did his work at Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital, where I'm working right now. It's part of the Harvard Medical School system of teaching hospitals, and I'm like kind of tripping out actually that I'm like, oh my gosh, this is where Norman Gershwin made this diagnosis. Gershwin syndrome, it develops secondary to temporal lobe epilepsy. And the temporal lobe is what surrounds the hippocampus. Temporal lobe epilepsy is the most common cause of epileptic seizure. And when you read Joseph Smith's own account of the first vision, it reads a lot like a clinical description, where he says, I was seized upon by some power which entirely overcame me and had such astonishing influence over me as to bind my tongue so that I could not speak. Thick darkness gathered around me, and it seemed to me for a time as if I were doomed to sudden destruction. So provocatively, can we think of the first vision as a product of the first seizure? And I would argue that divinity works through small and simple means. You may suppose that this is foolishness in me, but behold, I say to you that by small and simple things are great things brought to pass. Why assume that divine purpose cannot emerge from an electrochemical lightning storm in the brain of a young boy? Your God can't take a seizure and transform it into a revelation? Mine can. So if Joseph Smith's neurology is accurately described as Gershwin syndrome, which again is historically and scientifically impossible for us to make a claim with final certainty, would it automatically void his teachings? So it turns out that there is a guy named Fyodor Dostoevsky who is thought to have had temporal lobe epilepsy and Gershwin syndrome. Does that mean that we should throw away the brothers Karamazov? Should we throw away Crime and Punishment and all of Dostoevsky's other contributions to literature and human thought? Oops. So I would propose the question, was Dostoevsky insightful in spite of a neurological syndrome or because of it? Some closing thoughts here then. If I cannot tell you of earthly things, how can I tell you of heavenly things? Be careful. This would be my scientific counsel to you. Be careful about using one thing that you do not understand to try and explain another thing that you do not understand. Especially pertinent in spirituality. Don't be scared of materialism, guys. It has so much to offer. In summary, the general theory of spiritual minds that I propose is flexibly compatible with dualistic theism, monistic theism, dualistic atheism, monistic atheism, or agnosticism. Imagine a world in which people live to cultivate a wise, meaningful life path. Imagine a world in which wisdom and life meaning are the norms. That sounds paradisaical to me. Eternity is here and now. Wisdom is here and now. Meaning is here and now, and spirit is here and now. If these types of topics are interesting to you, my business partners here, we're actually starting a podcast that we're planning to launch on November 15th, which incidentally is the death anniversary of Emile Durkheim. It's called the Spiritual Brain Podcast, focusing on taking a survey of ancient wisdom and seeking to understand it through the lenses of contemporary science. And the website for that will be spiritualbrainpodcast.com. Wisdom is spiritual light, guys. So go forward and use your inner light. I love this verse from the Tao Te Ching, from the Eastern scriptures of wisdom. Use your own light and return to the source of light. This is called practicing eternity. My invitation to you is to go forward and to practice eternity. Thank you very much. See, I see hands. Yes, right here first.
When you look at collections of ancient Celtic wisdom literature or Jewish wisdom literature, talk here about wisdom coming from your experiences in life situations. Can you actually learn wisdom? Wisdom being taught from other experiences that you can incorporate? Or
So the question is, can wisdom be taught? And the indications, again, it gets complicated pretty quickly. It depends on how we're defining and operationalizing wisdom, especially in a laboratory setting, be like, oh, this person has 121 points of wisdom. It's like, what does that even mean? But it does appear that, yes, that wisdom is something that can be learned from others, that we can learn from the experiences of others. In fact, this is one of the likely reasons why our brains evolved to be so freaking large and to consume so many resources is because we're hyper-social organisms. We have this natural craving and desire to learn from the experiences of others. What do? We sit down and we tell stories to each other. And through that storytelling, we're transmitting these experiences and these understandings that don't necessitate us having them each time over and over and over again. Mike, yeah. That's an excellent question. So the question was, how does this play out in individuals and their brains where there is some kind of clinical condition that's been diagnosed? One of the studies that I'm also working on right now with this same stroke lesion mapping methodology is to look at hallucinations, particularly to look at visual hallucinations and to understand, okay, what's going on uniquely in the brains of individuals who present clinically with intrusive visual hallucinations. And I will be very interested to see, okay, do these networks that are implicated in clinical hallucinations map onto some of these other networks that seem to be related to quasi-perceptual phenomena? And yeah, spoiler alert though, I definitely don't anticipate that we're going to be like, oh, all spiritual experience is just hallucination. That's not where this is going. That's not my end game. Meredith.
Yeah, so particularly, and this is interesting because this relates back in to the way that social dynamics relate to spiritual experiences, that in autism, that there just aren't a lot of the same intuitive social cues that are read back and forth. And particularly when we think about some of the cognitive mechanisms that go into creating an image of God, those are social mechanisms that we're personifying a representation, that we're attaching at an emotional level to this personified representation. And so I definitely would anticipate you would see differences in autistic expressions of spirituality compared to like neurotypical expressions of how brains are participating and constructing and attaching to images of the divine. I think that's a really great, you should come do that research, Mary. Yeah. Yeah.
What is an indicator of a person who is like striving towards more of an intelligent side of that?
Let me dive in and see if I can wade through and get to the kernel of what you're asking here. Yeah. So one of the like curiosities that I perceive you inquiring about is whether spirituality can actually expand an individual's native intelligence in some way. So when we saw that relationship between the dopamine nucleus accumbens and between that abstract frontal region, that there was this inverse relationship, that if an individual is more easily rewarded by their own abstract thinking, that tends to correlate with less intelligence. So think about an individual who is intentionally trying to create distance mentally between abstract simulations and between their emotional reward. That sounds a heck of a lot like someone who's practicing mindfulness. One of the projects, this is not the lab that I'm in at Harvard Medical School, but one of the sister labs to us, is doing work to increase individual levels of intelligence. And they're taking right now non-invasive neural stimulation approaches where they're inducing what's called transcranial alternating current. So basically they'll put electrodes on the brain. They'll force the networks in the brain to reverberate at the same frequency. And that has demonstrated increases in individual levels of native intelligence. There hasn't been a full investigation like there should be on whether something such as mindfulness or spiritual discipline could also contribute to intelligence. I'm crazy biased, but I think that, yes, that there is going to be a way in which spiritual discipline can increase individual levels of native intelligence. Okay, I'm getting the time signal here. So let's do like these. Oh my goodness, you guys are so wonderful. Right here. That's right. Yep. 1 Corinthians 12 is where I was thinking also, that the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of thee. Neuro like in those scriptures, yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. So with how relevant dopamine is to a lot of what you're talking about. So I have ADHD, and so I take
So here's a dirty little secret. Pharmaceutical companies don't want us to know how their drugs affect our brains. There just aren't studies that pharmaceutical companies will fund to say, let's look at how our drugs are actually changing brain networks, because then there's a greater likelihood that the FDA will find something to take those drugs off the market. So unfortunately, as far as neural imaging for medication, there's a massive deficit of research that is because of capitalistic motivation. Yeah, if you can find it for me, dude, I will gladly do it. Yeah. Definitely. I think that we're being shoot out here. I'll stick around up here at the front if you guys want to ask some more questions and dialogue. But thank you so much. You've been wonderful.